Welcome to Amongst the Waves. I'm your host, Tanya Carroll, and I'm a surf coach, a Czech practitioner, and I'm completely caught up in all things surfing and getting behind the scenes of surfing culture. I have surrendered my soul to surfing. In each of the episodes of Amongst the Waves, I will bring you a perspective you might not have considered in the hope that it inspires you to be a better human and that it helps to build your stoke. Mitch Barraclough is a former WSL QS surfer who grew up on the east coast of Australia. Through his own injury at the age of 21, leaving the sport and then returning to the QS many years later, Mitch studied human movement as a way to understand his body. This then evolved into a career in the rehabilitation space, where now, after retiring from competitive surfing, he helps other athletes overcome physical and mindset challenges to succeed. Mitch enjoys being able to uncover and resolve problems that his clients from all sports present with, but he still surfs, now pain-free, on a daily basis.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast recording this morning. This morning I have with me Mitch Barraclough. Mitch, we met, when was that? Gosh, right before lockdown. 2019 in March at a DNS course.
Yeah, it was the first little bit of, call it curiosity, community curiosity about what COVID was.
God, yeah, it feels like years ago now, doesn't it? Well, it was years ago, it's over a year ago, but the world has changed so much since then.
Yeah, definitely. Well, our world.
Surfing. Our world has, yeah, definitely. I'm going to get into that with you because, I've got some big questions for you.
Cool.
When did you first start surfing?
Started surfing, I think I was probably like 9 or 10. Yeah. First memory I have of it was like standing up on my dad's board. Dad was teaching me and I remember thinking like, can I swear on this podcast?
Or is you can it? Absolutely swear.
Not probably in this language, but I remember like the frustration of like, how the fuck do I get this thing to turn? Like I could see other people going across, and that's kind of my first memory is like really wanting to get the board to go across the wave and not knowing how to make that happen yet.
How long did it take you before you learned how to do that?
I'm not sure. That's just the most sort of like
prominent memory.
Yeah. It's probably got that real emotional attachment. Like you really want something. It's probably one of my first memories of having something that's, I mean, it's, you know, you're in a natural environment and stuff, but it's also this mix of man-made versus, you know, and you're in the natural environment. So it's the first time of wanting to achieve something or to master something, not really achieve, master something like that. And I can't remember how long it took before that stuff started to happen. It was, there was a lot of, you know, getting used to the ocean and stuff that everyone goes through that I also remember after that, which is probably more,
You're in Manly at the moment.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in Manly?
Around this area on the Northern Beaches, if you know the Northern Beaches fairly well. Yeah. Like mum and dad.
Like Narrabeen.
Different houses. Yeah. Narrabeen. Dad had like, we lived in all sorts of places, all of the suburbs at some point from here to Warriewood, really. Yeah.
At what point, because when I met you, you were still on the qualifier series.
Yeah.
At what point did you think you could make it or wanted to make it a career of your own? Or was that ever a goal? Or did you just fall into being on the qualifier series?
No, I didn't fall into it. And I mean, all things considered, when you met me, the way that I'd gotten there was not the traditional route either. Like I'd sort of, that was my second stab at competitive surfing or pro surfing, if you want to call it that.
Yep.
As a kid though, that was my main thing. Like I was at a school early on that I was sort of not, you know, they were not, surfing wasn't a sport yet. Mm-hmm. Then, like 15 years ago or whatever, that more 18 years ago when I was 15, that wasn't really a recognized sport as it is now. And I was at my first high school wasn't really supporting it, and they had a pretty heavy sports curriculum for other things. Mm-hmm. And when I got out of there, I was able to kind of get out of there and go to school that gave me a bit more time for it. And I was about 15 then, and then I started doing a lot more coaching and a lot more like getting coaching and competitive coaching and stuff and entering a lot more contests. And the QS at that age to me at like 17 was such a huge thing, and it was terrifying probably, but I was doing the Pro Junior series, and that was, you know, I was you know, talking the talk. I was telling everyone that I wanted to do it, and I was doing the training, and I had I was putting a lot of time into it, but I'm sure we'll get into it later, but you know, there's a lot that comes together for it to happen well.
Yeah.
And I sort of got to 21 and I was a bit lost with it, to be honest. I hadn't built up a foundation of understanding where I was coming from within the sport to make that transition at that time. And I had a pretty serious injury as well. So I had surgery at 22 on my hip.
Yep.
And then that was the end of that, basically, for a few years. And I got back into it, stopped surfing for like 4 years, actually. And
wow.
Got back into surfing at 26, and you know, my current profession is a rehabilitative coach. Well, I help people with pain and injuries, basically. You know, with that skill set, I got myself back to surfing, and then back onto the QS at 27.
Right. Can we go back a step? Let's go back to where you were just saying that you were 21, just before the injury. Were you identified as having someone or as being someone with talent?
Within a talented group, no, but I was one of the kids in the coaching group, like the coach at the mm-hmm. time, and all of the kids in his were kids who were trying to have a career. Mm-hmm. So you sort of, within that group, I was definitely not the sort of, you know, I would ride of that group, absolutely not, but right. I was in that group. And so you're on track, if that makes sense, to be yep. moving towards. Yeah, I guess talent identification in, say, swimming and something would have been a lot better defined than in surfing, but I suppose so. But surfing was a lot, like, I've got a flag there as well, like the mentoring and stuff you're getting at that time compared to now. And so what talent ID really meant compared to just, like, it was pretty wild. It was good fun, but yeah, a bit different, I think.
A lot more unorthodox than what we would be seeing now.
Look, having systems around identifying talent and stuff is great in some regards, and it's not great in other regards. I'd say it's great in that it separates you're going to get a lot less of the crash and burn that ruins people's lives
yeah.
than you are with, like, that's a much better, that's a great positive about the current, you know, systems that are coming into play with surfing. But it's also, you know, it wasn't as separate then. It was sort of mixed up with who liked you and who didn't as well, I think probably more, I would say. I don't know if I've made that too clear, but essentially, yeah, it wasn't the most, you're in that group and you're there, but you're really making your own way within it.
Right. Because one of the reasons I want to speak to you today was about the changes that have happened and where we're going with surfing in the future, but also the things that probably weren't talked about when you were going through it at that age, like 18 years ago, we're talking about, and even now when I talk to some people, it's not perceived as a career.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas now what I see with athletes coming through, particularly now with the Olympics on the table, is that we need to get more professional. And I think that's where surfing has been trying to be going, but without taking away the aspect, and I know you're smiling here, taking away the reasons why people get into surfing in the first place, because that's this fine balance that I talk to people about. With people that I'm coaching at Urban Surf, as well as other coaches who I see who've got massive potential, who never wanted to go on the tour for reasons, probably because they not necessarily didn't see a career in it, but didn't want to lose the aspect of loving the ocean and loving that feeling, and having that feeling watered down or compromised by having to make it a job.
Yeah. It's also an incredibly unsafe, unsound, unsecure career path. Mm-hmm. That's just the reality of it. You really need to know what you're there for. And I don't know how many, I mean, those are tough questions to answer when you haven't had enough time on the earth to define what's really important to you, you know, aside from our biological needs as you grow through your different growth phases. So, how do you, like, it's not a secure career path, and there's a reason that you get surfers from particular areas doing really well for a while, because it is a little bit more secure for those people. It's not just that you get spot talent that's only there, like Good Waves comes into it, and the right coaching definitely comes into it. We can talk more about that later, like technique is, you know, really important.
Yeah.
And approach and stuff. But I think people intuitively can see that it might be a little bit mixed up for some people, like, and they can't unmix it for themselves yet. And I mean mixed up by, it might be a little bit mixed up between loving this thing and loving this lifestyle, loving everything and mastery of this sort of sport or art form, whichever way you want to look at it, enjoyment of everything that it brings, the connection that it brings, allowing you access to, you know, connect with different people with without surfing you might not get to, you know, connect with because it's such a great medium to connect with people through. I think probably that there's an intuitive understanding for a lot of people, particularly pretty grounded people, that as soon as you get into the career stuff, a lot of that that's the stuff that's quite different, and it's an unknown, not very secure career path, not very supported. I think people sometimes are just intelligent enough to go, like, that's probably not, you know, like they're not seeing something. They don't quite know what they're looking for, but they know that that's not it.
Yep.
Yeah.
So when are you happy to talk about your injury?
Yeah.
What happened?
Oh, it was like a chronic overuse injury. So I ended up having a labral tear in my hip, which is like, as you'll know, the hip capsule tore the, for people who don't know anatomy, it's like the top of your leg bone kind of sits out like this. Tanya can tell you this as well. And it sits into the socket. Yeah. And then that socket has like a fridge seal. And there's also a ligament right in the middle called ligament teres. It holds it in there. And that fridge seal got torn because my bone had grown like a spur sitting off the top of it. To what I now understand is I didn't have enough, you know, particular sort of motor control and stiffness around that hip. My back leg, so it's chronically internally rotated the way that I was surfing. I had a pretty low back hip style. And that little bony spur tore through that ligament and also tore through the labrum. So it felt like I would go for a surf and then it was like I was going to get in the car. And as soon as I went into internal rotation, it felt like my leg wasn't there anymore. So it was like a
pressing on a nerve.
It's like the fridge seal itself is gone, and that's the for your brain, like neurologically, that's your motor control. You need that suction there to feel where you are. And because I'd torn the ligament in there as well, it was like the hip wasn't there where it was. So it was like having like a, it was like if I had to kick something out with my heel in front of me, it was like I could do that at 20% for half a day, and then it would get 30%, 40% over about 4 or 5 days. It would improve, but then if I surfed again within those few days, it would get really, really bad. So it was sort of like knowing that I could only say, and I didn't understand it and I couldn't figure it out. Obviously this is before I was in
rehabilitation.
And any sort of health profession. So I really didn't have a clue what was going on, and I just sort of left it and sort of stopped surfing for a bit until eventually I found someone. And at that time it wasn't the label tear thing wasn't so it wasn't something I could find any information on, although you got to, you know, this was 21-year-old me looking. So I don't know how hard I was looking, but when I eventually found it, it was through a physio who was helping AFL players, and they had a lot of them, obviously, from the impact of their sport. So got the surgery. The surgery put my hip back together. I didn't stop the pain, and then got into what I'm doing now.
So I'm going to go back a step again. So with a bone spur on the body, or when the bone, for people who don't understand what bone spurs are, because I've got bone spurs in my spine as well,
yep.
Body starts to lay down calcification and that forms a bone spur. And often that's as a result of, like you said, an overuse injury or a weakness in the area that the brain and the nervous system goes, oh, we need extra support here. Yep. Something's not right in this joint and in this mobility of that joint. So we're going to support it by laying down extra calcification. Yep. And hence you have a bone spur. So that bone spur obviously got so sharp, and it probably wasn't, well, you said it wasn't the labrum tear that caused the injury in the first place, and it probably wasn't the bone spur that caused. The bone spur was as a result, a symptom of a degenerative, an instability in the pelvis.
Yeah, so you could have been like a subclinical instability, like something that certain people, that just means you don't know that it's there, but it's playing out whenever you're doing your sport. And it can happen at a particular speed of your sport. You might be stable walking around and you're not stable during your sport. You don't know it. You're just a little tight. But essentially, yeah, the issue that I was facing, to build on what you're saying, was that as I tried to rehab it, the traditional routes of rehabilitation didn't deal with the speed of surfing and didn't deal with the load and unload aspect of a surfboard going on and off a wave at different orientations of gravity. So basically, as the board was going up and down, my hip was having to do a whole lot of stuff that it didn't have the capacity to do. It didn't have the movement intelligence to do. So it was basically like talking to it in Chinese when it only spoke a few words of English, and it was just going into, you know, lockdown around the tissues. And that was, yeah, that spur. And that, yeah, we can get into that. But essentially, it was at that time when I didn't understand it, it was a bit of a frustrating thing, but I really learned a lot from having that one injury. I learned a lot. Yeah.
Before that, did you have, like, what did you do in school? Did you think that you were just going to be a surfer? And that's okay to think that. Or did you have a backup plan if it didn't work out?
I always find that question really hard to answer because I think surfing for me was a great, like, I still love surfing. Surfing is like being in the water is yeah, I love it. You know, I love it. I still get excited. I still get that like nervous excitement about going surfing. Like none of that's changed. The only thing that's changed from doing it competitively is like new boards. Like I just don't get as excited about new boards anymore. everything else, like, I still get pumped about, you know, like just going on a surf trip or surfing with my wife or surfing with my friends. Like I absolutely love it. And it's, you know, really important part of life. Like even though it's just a fun thing, it's just it's got so many good aspects to it. Growing up saying, yeah, it's definitely this thing that I was saying, I'm going to be a surfer. But I think, to be honest, that was me not understanding, like I mentioned before. I don't think I had the understanding at that age of several other factors that were playing out for me. So the need to be, you know, have a social standing, the need to feel, you know, good about this X, Y, and Z, the need to, and I think, you know, things that we go through naturally to figure out, for me, my desire to go towards surfing probably was partly tangled up in that. I'm not sure if entirely, like I was passionate about the sport, but I don't think I would have been able to have a concise conversation about which parts I was passionate about and how much time I was willing to give it. It was just like, that's what I'm doing. Like I'm going to surf, which is fine if that works out. But so no, I didn't really have a backup plan. It was just like, that's what I'm doing. And the amount of effort that I was putting in reflected that that's what I was going to do, you know, with the training and stuff. But I was also putting a ton of effort into partying and girls, like, you know. So, and I, looking back now, I think that some more understanding about what's important, and if I could have communicated, like, it's hard to communicate with yourself at that age anyway.
Like I said, you don't have a life experience to be able to understand what that life is like outside that bubble, because as a kid, that's all the perception you have, and to get perception you have to have age and you have to have life experience.
Yeah, and it takes a particularly good kind of coach or mentor to be able to do that, and they don't have to be a surfer. At the end of the day, they're better off not being a surfer, because most surfers are going to have their own stuff tangled up in it. Surfing is a bit pretty warped culture in some aspects, and a lot of older surfers, you know, I don't want to be, I'm really grateful for everything that I've learned. I'm really grateful for things I've been exposed to. But, you know, just from watching side on, and maybe not the coaches I've had, but watching other people's coaches and stuff, there's some really warped stuff going on 10 years ago. I don't know if it still goes on now. I'd assume it's less. But I think, to understand, to give you the proper answer to the question is like, no, I wasn't thinking about anything else. I was just thinking about surfing. You know, I think that if I was going to talk to a kid in the same position, I would spell it out in a way that allowed them to have tools to think that process through in a way that was so that it was practical enough. Like having the goal of being a pro surfer is definitely the critical ingredient, but it's the first ingredient, and there's about 50. So you've got to. And it's really important, like as far as mentoring goes, that people get mentored through that process as they develop as people. And it's not that this is not to whinge about, I'm super grateful for my experience. I've got to surf all over the world. I've been able to compete all over the world. Because it didn't work out the first time, I have a career that I'm really passionate about and I love. But, you know, I also want to give back to surfing, which has given me so much. And so that's where I'm coming from when I say this stuff. It's just that I really think that the type of mentoring for people of that age needs to be the right, given in the right way for them to feel empowered and for them to take those steps. Otherwise, you're not going to listen. Like at 19, 18, I could not give a fuck. I was going to do what I was going to do. And if anyone told me any different in a way that I couldn't feel like I was being empowered by that conversation, I was, and my attitude too, I was probably going to tell that person to fuck off. I was pretty.
If someone told you you were not going to do something or you weren't able to do it, you're headstrong and going to do it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do it your way.
Yeah. And again, like you need that. You need that, and you just need to be really smart about how you express it.
Yeah. And that, I think that value needs to be not harnessed, but driven on a path with the other things that you said. So not say that an athlete can't do that and can't be a professional surfer, but get to the core of why they want to do it and use that as part of, like you said, that whole toolkit rather than just the one thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for any athlete, and the athletes that I work for now, like I've had a couple athletes coming up to this Olympics, not surfers as well, sprinters and stuff. And, you know, they are like, it is so make or break any sport. And it feels make or break. Like it's easy as a coach or an adult to step back and go like, timelines, guys, you know, you've got years of being good at this. It's going to be all right. But the emotional part of each event and stuff and competition and the grind of a season as well, it's hard to manage. And yeah.
A good coach will do that.
Yeah.
Do you think that, I spoke to G Cormack, who I think you know, a few months ago. And one of the things that she struggled with after she stopped snowboarding, after she was injured, was the identification. So identifying just with that one thing, not being able to see yourself as something different. So kids who come into this, or athletes who come into it, or parents, because we're going to have a lot of parents now with the Olympics being as prominent as they have been for surfing. I know they're sitting out there waiting because they think their kids got talent. So how do we, as coaches and as mentors,
yeah,
not teach people, but show people that they're more than just one thing, or they're more than just that sport, because that identity crisis that they have, or that they might have, I don't know whether you had that with your injury, but when you wrap yourself up so much in that one thing, it's a complete like tearing out of the rug from underneath you when you realize that you can't be that thing.
Yeah. And look, I'm going to be probably a little bit, it sounds like I'm being a touch harsh when I say this, but you know, it can play out the other way. Like injuries can be a great excuse for people. You know, I don't want to be, if anyone's listening with an injury and you're a kid and you're feeling that, like the reason it's a great excuse is because of all these other things that they don't have tools to call on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think, I've kind of lost track of my thoughts on the last question you had, but what I think I was trying to get to is like, you really, when you know where you're coming from, and that's also like we've talked about, age specific. Mm-hmm. If you, as an athlete, if you know where you're coming from and it's age specific, as in, you know, I know where I'm coming from a lot differently at 33 than I did at 21, but there's still an appropriate level of knowing where you're coming from at each age and each time in your life, I believe, you know, that's my understanding thus far, then it's a little easier to just like read what's actually happening, you know, because yeah, you might be having a shocking season and quite that maybe is like, let's like it may mean that in the near future, you're not going to be on the Challenger Series and you're not going to be then anywhere near the CT. And if you're not on the Challenger Series, you're not making enough money unless you're a fucking well-paid free surfer in the top 20 or 30 and you're young enough that you can make it work. You are not making enough money for what most people are then going to want later on.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's what I was going to get to, because that was my next question. Yep. Can you explain the difference between qualifier series and I'm going to say the championship tour, and then we're going to get to the Challenger Series after that, because up until really last year, the Challenger Series was only just really introduced.
It was, but in effect, it was already there with the 6,000s, but I'll get back to it. But yeah, essentially the qualifying series is where you make your start. So you build up points on this set of series of competitions. There's like, I'm not sure how many there are around the world, but there's tons. And there's sort of 1,000 on 1,500 level ones where you sort of, the most points you can get is 1,000 if it's a 1,000 event, or the most points you can get is a 10,000 if it's a 10,000 event. And roughly qualification for the CT is usually about 20,000 points.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, on the QS or the Challenger Series now, but actually it was in the QS. I don't know what that point system is for the Challenger Series, so you have to double check that. But you basically work your way up that, you know, you work your way up that, and it's a lot more, it's the 1,000s feel a lot more grassroots. When you're at a 6,000, it feels like you're a professional athlete. When you're at a 1,000, the athletes are there, a lot of the same guys will go and do them, but that it's a different kind of vibe, and it's a lot
different level of competition.
Yeah, look, the competition level is different, but as you go through the rounds, it gets pretty fucking hard, to be honest. Like, there's some really great servers, and it's fun to be a part of. Like, if you can remember that you're there to enjoy competing, it's pretty cool. You know, you can get some good, like, Yeah, just rare to get that type of situation as you go through life that really forces you to perform. And when I say forces you to perform, it's like it's something that you're doing for yourself. And you, when you do it, like when it comes out well and it happens, it's like it's pretty cool, you know. And it's the only other time I've had that is when I stopped surfing, I went to kickboxing and I was competing there. You get the same thing, but it just sucks because you're kind of having to hurt someone else to do that. And that's, you don't have that with surfing in other sports. Like you can get those moments of like the waves enough to give you a bit of fear if there's some size and stuff like that. And they're only going to reward you if you like throw yourself off a solid section or, you know, really commit to it. And it's obvious to everyone when you have or when you haven't. And if you can get yourself into the position on the right wave and get priority and blah, 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 and do that, it feels great.
Like it's, and you get rewarded for that.
You're rewarded for that. But it, yeah, the feeling is like you've really, you can't consciously, you have to do it at the time. It's not something that you can really, it happens at the time and then you're kind of doing it at the time and it's all great. So that, but basically back to the question, it's, yeah, and then the CT is where you've really made it basically. So from, if you look at the difference between just the whole setup of a 1000 QS and, you know, a CT event, they are vastly different things. And the way the sport's being performed at the CT level is vastly different.
So more and, professional and more sponsors in that area?
And on a purist level, the surfing is very different. Yeah, very, very different. And there's,
unpack that a little bit for me, Mitch.
Okay, so if you are someone who's lived on a beach, I know probably a lot of your listeners are going to be like urban-based surfers as well for the wave stuff. Yep. So, but even there's going to be a bit of a hierarchy around how that plays out, just because even in that situation, waves are a resource. It's not an infinite number of waves in a pool in an hour or whatever you're allotted time, and it's not an infinite number of waves at a beach. Yeah, like they're a resource and everyone wants their bit of the resource. And it's up to us as everyone's job to make sure that that happens in a harmonious way for everyone from beginner to, you know, and everyone has responsibilities. Like the top better surfers out there have responsibilities, and I won't say better, more experienced surfers have responsibilities, and the first day learners also have responsibilities. Like it's, everyone needs to work together to make that work, especially if you live in Sydney, right?
Especially in COVID.
Yeah, 100%. But then like, say we've got that, you know, that sort of top of the food chain, bottom of the fun. I don't want to use that. I hate that sort of approach. But say we have like different level experience.
More experience, level. Yep.
Yeah, more experience. And in a 1000, you might be that person. Like if you go down and have a look at the best surfer in the pool, you're probably that on the 1000, you might be one of the decent surfers in the 1000, probably just average, really. And there'll be a couple of guys, you know, clearly outstanding. And so they're like from the whole whatever stretch of the Northern Beaches, they might be the best surfer, might be, or, you know, a good chunk of the East Coast, they might be there. And then you get to a CT and those guys, it's like that times 10. Like the difference really is considerable. So it's the type of thing where when you go and watch like that top level surfing, if you've ever had the opportunity to do that, especially in waves that allow that type of surfing to happen.
Yeah.
Because it's a big difference in the waves on a 1000 most of the time to the waves in a CT. And to do this, like to do the same turns relative to the speed and size of the waves and opportunity on the waves on a CT at most locations, that is a whole other skill set, and it's a much bigger skill set.
Yeah.
And they need to be able to do it across a huge range of conditions.
Is there a big drop off? So I know that listening to podcasts and talking to surfers, there's sometimes the fear that a lot of the time there's a fear that they get onto the CT and that the biggest fear is falling off.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, if you get on the CT for a lot of guys and then like, yeah, I mean, to get there is a different thing. It's to get there is like I said, you're surfing one type of condition, like a lot of the time. It's not always true, and it's probably changing a bit now. But and I hope with the Challenger Series, I haven't seen where they're running the events, but maybe that's why they've done that. I hope that's why they've done that, to sort of bridge that gap between conditions.
They have, yeah.
Awesome. So that makes total sense, because if you've done 5 to 10 years on the QS, say, like from when you started at 15 doing a couple and then you end up on the CT at 23, and you haven't had the opportunity to go and consistently surf really quality waves in between competing, you just put all your resources into competing, you're all of a sudden it's like you've had a little A4 piece of paper to draw your art on to get judged on. And then all of a sudden you're on this like wall sized canvas to draw your art on, and you've only got 12 events or whatever it is to do that better than guys who've been doing it for however long. So it really is with surfing, like the top guys have been the top guys also, not just because they're so talented and amazing athletes, they're also top guys because they've had the opportunity to be the top guys.
Because they've got that experience on that particular tour, in those waves, in those conditions, surfing against those people continuously.
Yeah, on top of incredible talent, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to take anything away from them. I'm just, there's also a numbers game to it. There's always both sides to the coin. You know, there is the real thing of they're just that good. And then there's also the thing of they're also that good and getting better very quickly because of what's around them.
When you had your injury and you came back again, how long between that was it? You said you were 23, was it, when you had the injury or surgery?
21, when I pretty much couldn't really surf anymore. Got surgery at 23, but I was still trying to surf 21 to 23. I was sort of trying to do some, I had a sponsor and they were kind of cool with me trying the free surfer thing. So I was trying to travel around and get some, you know, do some photos and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And for those who don't understand what the free surfing is, that is sponsors will pay you just to be on the free surfing tour, just to go to locations where they get great shots for their marketing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the top level of it. Again, what I was doing was just up and down the east coast of Australia. And then and kind of trying to get, first you need momentum. They don't give it to you first most of the time. First you need to be in the magazines and know the right people and get some shots. And then after that, they might give you a budget, you know, where you can go and they'll pay for you to go and get the shots. And then after that, they might pay you flat out. So there's a bit of a stepping stone there. But I was essentially trying to build up that. And then I was working just like, landscaping at the time, and then I was 22 or something, and that was basically how I was funding myself, was just laboring and landscaping. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of realized that first realization of like, I don't know how for me it was how do I move forward? I don't have the type of tools I need to really move forward in a practical fashion towards something that, sorry, go on.
In surfing.
Surfing, and also, yeah, definitely in surfing, like, you need to know, like, you know, like, what is networking? How do you approach people? How do you make people feel good about themselves in a way that benefits both of you? And not to be sort of manipulative, just to connect with people. Like, learning how to connect with people is really important, and it matters. And being able to be yourself and that person to be themselves, and you're probably going to be different, but you're both passionate about this one thing. You kind of want something from them. They want something from you. How do you do that in a way that's clear, concise, it has the right boundaries?
And authentic.
And it's authentic and you're being yourself. And that's, you know, how do you do that? That's a skill set that I didn't have, you know.
Yep.
And I didn't feel comfortable about not being myself. So what I tended to do was just shut people down or shut them out or not have that conversation or not try to have that conversation because it felt wrong to me to try and get something out of someone, which is
I ask for money for something that you loved.
So, yeah, not like I just at the core of it, I couldn't break it down into like a simple tool, like value, like what is the value of a free surfer? You know, until you sit down and write out like, okay, that's actually incredibly inspiring for someone else, you know, and it gives you an opportunity to be in a position to make a change. All of these things that I couldn't conceive of at the time, which later on I've understood more and more about, I just didn't get, you know, I just thought like, all right, getting paid to surf is just like too, like you can't, like it's not gonna happen, it's too good. Yeah, it is too good, but in the way that it's too good is what you need to understand, I think, if anyone's listening and they're feeling that. You need to understand the value of what you're doing and how you can add more value to it. You know, connection and being yourself is always gonna be a big part of that, connection with other people. So I basically stopped at 23, had the surgery, and then I didn't really start surfing again. I moved to Melbourne. I just bailed. I was like, the job as well. I also didn't know like how to be with him where I was going as another profession, because it was obvious that like, I was like, clearly I wasn't making the right choices with surfing, and then I wasn't making the right choices with, you know, and yeah. I've really got to say like it from the outside, it wouldn't have looked like I was doing much with surfing, although I was having this inside like desire, and I'd never won any major competitions. I'd done okay in a few, but yeah, definitely no, like I was no Owen Wright or anything like that. I just want everyone to understand, like I'm someone who has put a lot of time into competing, but I've put a lot more into competition and financially into competition as well than I've got back.
Yeah.
That's the reality of a lot of surfing, I think. But I've also had an incredible experience. You know, I've been in touch with different parts of the surfing. And you know, I've had coaches who are sort of ex-world champions and things like that. So I've had a bit of a mixed time with it, I think.
Yeah, yep.
But yeah, I didn't get back into surfing until I was sort of 26. So I lived in Melbourne, started doing the personal training stuff. I started that when I was about 22, just building into it. Mm-hmm. And then I got into the rehab stuff alongside that, alongside personal training. I was doing some of the Czech stuff, I think similar to yourself.
Yep.
And then got back, moved back to Sydney. I built a little business down in Melbourne, barely surfed, just got into like lifting weights and chasing girls with my friends. It was super fun. And just
probably exactly what you needed right then, to get away from the northern beaches and get away from what
that
expectation that probably was on you from being known for being on the, like being a surfer.
I think I'd moved away from it by then, and I was, my response to not knowing how to handle it was annoyance and disregard for it. And I was probably pretty vocal. I mean, just to my friends and stuff, to no one. I mean, just the guys who were listening, that I was like, fuck, you know, surfing's this and surfing's that, just because I didn't understand how to separate the good and bad. And there is good and bad in surfing. I really want to flag. Like I said before, there's some pretty warped ideas and dynamics that happen with surfing, just from, I think, from people just not understanding how to be different. And I've been a part of that, and I'm, you know, not understanding, and I feel like I'm not a part of that now. And that's just through understanding. But so when I came back to it, I was like, I was a different version of myself. I felt much more solid in myself. I'd sort of gone to a city I didn't know a single person in with $300, and I'd built a business that went pretty well, and I'd sold it. So I kind of had a different way of interacting with myself about, yeah, okay, I can do things in a step-by-step fashion, and you know, I learned a lot there. So when I came back, I didn't really think about surfing. I came back to Northern Beaches. I was going to go again in like another year. I was like, well, I'll go back, see my family and stuff for a bit, and then I'm just going to go travel for a couple of years. And what ended up happening was I came back. I was here for longer. And then I ended up, well, long story short, I ended up getting married a while later. And then the way that I traveled around the world was with surfing in the end. So I ended up doing both together. But I really only trained up for like 2 years again after, but I was so much stronger and knew so much more about movement and stuff like that. And I was applying a lot of stuff that I'd really like knuckled down on to learn with the movement and health stuff. I did a lot of study. I got a lot of mentoring.
Yeah.
I did a lot of yoga therapy. I started that at about 20 and I had that going alongside. So I understood a lot about how to train and how to move. And then I started surfing for a couple of years. And then I just was like, well, I'm going to do it. I was like, I think 27 or 28. I did a few years of all the comps that I could do, all the ones that I could get to, Portugal and Spain, and did anyone in France? Yeah, I think Portugal, Spain, all around Australia.
Still on the QS?
Now?
No, then you were still.
That was all the QS.
At that point in your career, did you then think I might be able to make it on the CT now, or were you happy to be on the QS?
It's a really interesting dynamic because, like, again, we're talking like 1,000s, 3,000s, making a few heats, and locally that, you know, you feel momentum. But essentially, like, it's really important to know where you're coming from. Mm. And you have to know, like, if you're going to go and compete with surfing, you have to be cool with the fact that probably the thing you're definitely going to get is you're going to get better at surfing. You know, that's it. And I was cool with that. I ran my business the entire time I was competing. You know, I definitely put a lot of finance into it because it's, as an athlete, like you live as an athlete, like you're training a lot and you're putting a lot of time into it, and you need to get your body managed and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the travel is expensive. And then, you have to kind of play a game, which people want to hear from you. Oh, like you're 28 doing the QS. Are you going to make the CT? And what are you going to say? You know, like you're on the spot.
Yeah.
So it's like you can avoid the question and say, well, I'm just there to get better at surfing. But then that also has a connotation for them. So you've got to be kind of brazen and go like, well, yeah, like I really want to compete and I really want to do well. You know, you have to kind
give
of
give an answer that they want to hear.
Well, you have to be given an answer that's still true to you, but that doesn't count you out.
Yeah.
They'll count you out because there's fucking 2,000 other people trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, again, like I'm not someone who's made it anywhere near the top of the QS. So I don't know what that's like there when you're sort of at the coalface of being really close. And I just don't think at a surfing level, my surfing was ever refined or good enough to be at that level. I mean, it's probably pretty close. But there's things that I've learned about technique through that process about that I just didn't know before. Like the coaching I had at at 15 to 20 compared to the coaching you can get now is considerably different. Like
on a technical level,
I understand now about surfing that I had zero idea about for the last until this year, 2 years ago.
Yeah. Do you think that has changed across the board in surf coaches, or do you think that's still coming through?
I think there's only a couple who can put together enough of an understanding of either body mechanics and wave mechanics. I think that's the missing link. People don't get wave mechanics, and it is so, so different to body mechanics on a flat surface. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a reason that not that many coaches are that good at surfers. And there's a reason the coaches that are good surfers are the ones coaching, you know, people on the CT and on the top of the QS.
Because they understand both sides of that.
They may not be able to verbalize very much of either, but they can verbalize enough of both to tell the competitor in the language the competitor is going to understand what to do. The competitor can then go and execute it and get 2 points higher on their next set of heat waves than they were getting before. And it may be, you know, completely, you know, non-concise or like unwell, not, it might not be very well-formed language around it. But as long as the surfer understands what they need to feel on the wave, then they're going to be able to do it. But to get, like, for myself, I really, like, I'm someone who's, like, I'm movement-based. Like, my profession is movement. Understanding movement is a passion for me as well, probably just as much as surfing, probably more of a passion than surfing, really, for myself. So then how do you position your body is, like, fundamental, and I don't actually think that many people get that. No, I don't think many coaches get that either, from what I can see. Yeah, I just don't see. You'd have a lot better surfing going on if they did.
Yep, I totally agree. Totally agree. Do you think it's possible to make it on as a surfer? This is such an individual question, because it comes from the perspective of me sitting back and watching this for years and only coming into it as a coach in the last couple of years, but watching it for so long and watching the sport, or watching the corporation around the sport of surfing flounder so many times in terms of business. Do you think it's possible for surfers these days to become better at branding themselves in the respect that they may not need sponsorship to survive on the tour? Very big question, I know. And
that model worked really well for me, as long as we're very clear on the level of the tour that I was doing was the 1 in 3,000s.
Yeah.
You know, like, I worked the whole time. I worked online, doing online coaching, online PT. I kept the same clients I've had 5 years ago. I'm still with, like, through that whole period of time with me now. So it does work, but you have to, like, I was 28 when I was doing it, and I wasn't, I think a better thought to have, rather than just directly answering the question, is, like, if you want to look at it, like, understand what you're actually engaging with when you want to surf. Like, if you want to have a career with surfing, you need to be winning heats and you need to be getting through heats, and that will award you access into the next level of competition. And then eventually that level of competition will have some money, and then eventually you'll be having enough money where it's its own business as well as a sport. But the confusion that I see with people is mixing up going through those levels with also going through the levels of the culture around it. And I don't want to take that away from anyone, because for some people that particular support network within surfing is very, very important. But I will say that the dynamics within that culture are often not the ones that are going to allow someone to be open-minded enough within how they're thinking about what they're doing to also be making money through another pursuit.
Right.
To also be feeding themselves different thoughts that allow them to step in and step out of that world. I mean, the dynamics within it are probably not there yet to allow that many people to do it and have an ongoing career with surfing. Like, I just supported myself and got myself in and did all the events and did all of that and worked, but then I've stepped back out of it. And now my relationship with surfing now is helping other surfers who have pain. You know, that's my business is based around that. And that's a great way for me to interface with the culture. But it also allows me to not get caught up in some of the unhealthier dynamics that are playing out all the time. And they play out from top to bottom. It's really something that people need to understand if they want to go through that process.
Are you willing to tap into some of that and explain that a little bit more? Because I think it's something that, looking from an outsider's perspective, looking in, I think that what you're talking about is exactly the thing that makes surfing and the culture of surfing somewhat hard to understand from an outsider's perspective, like that warped, you've mentioned that a couple of times, that warped area of surfing, and not pinpointing names or anything like that, but what is that?
Well, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't want to overstep my mark. I'm talking from my experience.
But, sure.
For me, my experience with it is, there's no one person's right, one person's wrong. That's how it's going to feel once it's already gotten to the point where it's unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and might be right and wrong, sub that out for, you know, in the in circle and not in the in circle. When that's happened, it's already kind of gone too far, and it's not a harmonized, supportive environment. And whether the
break that down a little bit more, because I think what exactly are you talking about? The coaching? You're talking about the sponsors? Are you talking about the culture? Are you talking about
just like if you're a listener, go for a surf at your local. And
right.
And pay real attention to which part you're playing. You know, like what's the part you're playing in this thing that we're all trying to do? And again, it's easy for me to say this when I'm sitting in my living room on the computer chatting to you about it. And it's something that I've thought about a lot. But yeah, it's hard for me as well. Like I go out there, it's a resource. I want my part of the resource. There's going to be a part of me that comes up that feels like I've earned X amount of the resource. That's the first thing, is like, well, not really. That's actually not true. You know, I have a relationship with it, sure, but so does everyone else.
Yep.
Yeah. And there's, like I said, there's responsibility on different levels and understanding where you're at within that. But the grassroots level of surfing still has a lot of that stuff of you're in, you're out, you're this, you're that. And what ends up happening is, to be in and out, people stop acting like themselves. They start acting like how they think they need to act. And then it's gone beyond surfing. And then they're surfing how they think they need to surf to be in that. And then they're behaving. And then it's like, you'll see someone in the surf, you know, and they're one personality, and then you meet them in a business environment where they can no longer get away with that, or it doesn't serve them to be that way anymore. And they're a different thing. Like maybe they're your real estate agent. They're a totally different, you know, person then, because whatever, the dynamics have changed. But on a basic level, coaching, competitors interacting with other competitors, sponsorship teams, there's a hierarchy playing out all the time, but it's taken too seriously, like people putting too much stock on where they sit within that. And it is incredibly magnetic. When you're in it, it's quite hard to not let it. Like I was doing a lot better when I started on the QS, when I first started back to at the end, because I felt really worn down by that. And I wasn't sure if I was playing into it or if I wasn't, and it was getting harder to just be a part of it, because you know, you can have different sort of tools to deal with this thing.
Yep.
But essentially the best tool that you're going to get is understanding, and understanding is harder to get. And it's really hard to get in a situation where you trying to surf, like you're not there. It feels like, you know, people are going to feel blindsided by something that happens in the surf. And the trick is that, like, you know, whatever, like, so say someone, they're sort of an intermediate surfer and they're out and they've been surfing a spot for a few weeks and they're feeling like, okay, cool, I'm getting my head around this spot. Like I'm getting my head around in. And then the day they paddle out, it's a little bit better than the day before. That guy is so excited to surf. Sorry, that guy or girl is so excited to surf. They feel like they've nailed this bank. It's a new level for them. There's a lot of drive there, but a lot of things taking their focus in this particular situation. Like it's maybe a little bit bigger, you know, and the waves are really good and they've got a turn they want to focus on, or got a paddling they want to focus on. But then some dude who's grown up there, who's an advanced surfer, or an older surfer maybe, or...
Yeah.
He or she comes out and they spot this excitement and they spot this attitude.
Naivety?
It's not naivety. It's not, because and it really, to be honest, pisses me off when I hear, because like I'm someone who's like, I've literally done it. Like I've done the tour thing. Like I've been there at what this thing that's essentially everyone's not playing at, but that's where it comes from. That's where this dynamic comes from. And you hear people who, like, it's like as soon as they get above someone, they're very quick to point and say, well, you're this or that, whether or not having got you, but they say you're naive or you don't understand. And you, That's not it. It's like, this is a dynamic that's complicated and it's not going to be solved with a one word. Like it's complicated. So this
it's deep,
right? And this intermediate guy's got so much going on this, and this advanced guy has already probably picked this, seen it, and then he's going to do something with it because his available consciousness is broader at that time. The skill set required for him to be in the surf is he's not using all of his skill set. So he's got spare energy to still be looking around. And then this other bloke probably doesn't, or this other girl or guy doesn't.
Yep.
They clash. They get in each other's way.
Yeah. You know?
But the seeds for that clash going badly have landed at like, have started way before the situation actually happened.
Way before they get in the water even, yes.
Yeah, their attitude toward the whole thing. So then you've got the outcome might be, if it's positive, you might get like, you know, if they're able to laugh it off, cool, but take responsibility, probably it can be positive. But it's not, most of the time it's not, because the advanced guy's kind of been waiting for this in some way or form, and then this intermediate guy was already hyped up because, you know. And I'm not saying that I'm like immune to it. Like it's something I have to manage all the time. And with COVID, like, you know, surfing Manly in Queenscliff in COVID has been like, oh, it's so intense, you know, and it's been a real learning curve. And surfing with my wife where, you know,
wanting to protect her while she's out there as well.
Yeah, like some of the way that men treat women in the water, when it's your wife, it's like, it's really hard. Like I've definitely had like argument type conversations with people that I didn't want to have because you've seen them paddle around, you know, but that's that same thing. It's like, as soon as you bought into, this is where I am in the hierarchy now and I've earned it and I'm going to be here and I'm going to behave like that, then you're playing winning and lose and it's already gone. And like I don't have an answer for it, but like surfing's a resource, like waves are a resource, and there's not always enough waves and there's always going to be this figuring out of how to make that work for everyone.
Yeah.
But I think the culture of in and out probably is fear-based, in that there's not enough of this. We want to make sure we get it. And I think that that dynamic is what goes from bottom to top.
It's so much deeper and so much more broad than what I understood localism to be. And that's what I think people will label this, but it's so much more than just that.
Mm.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you were to say that the example I chose sort of lends itself to calling it localism. But, you know, to like, let's just take the place out of the war, put two Australian guys up in Indonesia, same thing's going to happen. It's just that one of them, you know, put two Brazilian guys and two Australian guys up in the water in Indonesia, and the same dynamics are playing out all the time. And none of them are locals to that particular spot.
Yeah.
And there's generally more tolerance when no one's from there. I'll agree with that for sure. But I don't think the issue is localism. I think labeling it that is kind of an excuse. Like it.
Misunderstanding actually what's going on.
Yeah. And I'm not saying I do. I just, the only way for me to move through that and to sort of, because I was experiencing different dynamics when I was competing and I found them quite draining. And I didn't know how to interact with him in a way that was positive for myself. So that's sort of set me on a learning path about it, about dynamics, about relating, about understanding. Other things have obviously driven me there as well. But that has been the one thing that's, it kind of feels like it just doesn't bother me nearly as much as it would have 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But that's only through understanding, like I've said. Yeah.
How do you, if you've got young athletes who want to be surfers who you're coaching, how do you coach them through something like that? Or is that not part of what your coaching covers?
I haven't got any like teenage surfers, so it's hard to know. What I would say was the most important thing, like for the younger sort of sprinters and stuff like that, there's similar dynamics that go down in all sports. The only difference is the track doesn't disappear, you know, after 5 seconds.
The resource is finite in that case. Yeah.
So that adds another element of kind of excitement, and that kind of triggers a lot of people, you know, with surfing. I think it's just the pure excitement of, am I going to get a wave, is probably something that needs to be called out for being a bit of a, you know, call, you're already pumped like when you go for a surf.
Yeah.
But when I'm working with these people and they're going through these different, who are at the top of their sport and they're going through the different ups and downs of winning and losing, the biggest thing is coaching, is building for me and that athlete a relationship between us, which is realistic and trustworthy. We can be honest with each other about what we think X, Y, and Z is, but also as a mentor, knowing when that person, that bit of information that you're giving is more about yourself than them. So not in that, like at 33, something is important that isn't important at 21. It's just not. And it's too much understanding, and it's going to take them away from the goal, which is to run the race well. So it really comes back to making sure that building a foundation of sort of harmony around why you are doing what you're doing or why they're doing what they're doing. If it's a sprinter, then understanding what that foundation is for them. Like it's essentially about running. And if you're surfing, it's essentially about riding a wave, and it's not about anything else. And having that as the core can help people change where and when they're going to surf as well, which is, and the, you as someone with experience, you can also outline the dangers of buying into a hierarchy, particularly when you're going to be the top of it. Because it's real easy to do when you happen to be in the position, like same as me as a kid, it's really easy to buy into, well, I'm the best surfer out here, therefore I get all the waves.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and that, but what I think the coaching has to be around is the cost of that is astronomical. But the only way you're going to get that across, you can't teach that in fear. You have to get that across in comparison to harmony, in comparison to understanding all the time in a way that that person can relate to.
And I mean, receive that information.
Yeah. Harmony with themselves. Like there's always going to be tension and excitement and fear and stuff around surfing. Like waves are 6 foot, people get scared. Waves are 10 foot, people get more scared. Like waves are 2 foot, the beginner's scared. Waves are 2 foot, the QS guy's trying to do Hail Marys to the flats because he's got no fear. Like it's just a different, yeah.
With Olympics being, with surfing being an Olympic sport now, how do you see that changing the sport going forward? And also incorporating, how do you see wave pools changing the art of the sport going forward, or the art, the body of the athlete?
I was actually wanted to ask you, is there like a local seat at the wave pool? I feel like it's still happening.
Look, so as a staff member of Urban Surf, I am on what we call, I think it's called, it's just changed the name to Melbourne Surf, Urban Surf Rider, Board Riders Association or something. So I'm on that page, and a lot of our staff are, and we make that public knowledge. It's not a big secret, but we're on that so that we can see and monitor what goes on with the people who are surfing at Urban Surf. And I would like to say that there's not a hierarchy, but I think there is definitely a level of, I don't want to say the word localism, and this is me saying this as Tanya, not as a staff member, because Urban Surf promotes being equal to everybody across the board. And we do that really well for most of the time, but I think I can feel and see that starting to slip in a little bit. And there are certain people who are members or who are part of that hierarchy who actually are really good and do bring people back into line and are trying to sort that out before it becomes a big problem.
Yeah.
So there's, but in terms of staff and in terms of my experiences in the water at Urban Surf have always been nothing but positive.
Awesome.
Yeah. And that's not because I go in saying I'm a staff member. I get recognised probably two or three sets in that I'm a staff member, or when I start talking to the staff who are working there at the time, that's when people start to recognise it. But I have not felt intimidated by anybody.
Awesome.
I've been there. But again, saying that, I'm surfing in cruiser. I'm not surfing in intermediate or the higher levels yet. So
that's actually a really good point as well, because there is an element of responsibility, like I said before, is also relative to what the waves are doing. And
that changes.
Yeah, everyone has a responsibility to not be an issue.
Yes.
But you need to know where you're coming from
to
be able to not go out that day and to be able to wait for another day so that, you know, the lesser useful part of your ego doesn't drive you into doing something which then becomes someone else's problem.
I totally understand that, because I stand on the back at the surf academy or stand on the edge of that lagoon whilst I'm trying to learn more about those more advanced levels, and I can pick the people who shouldn't be in those in those settings, and it's sometimes it's hard because you want them to be able to learn how to be in that setting or be in that wave or be out in those height or size waves out in the surf, but those people have got to have that level of respect for that wave, but also for the more advanced people who have the experience with that. So that pecking order is
Yeah, that conversation should happen out of the water.
Yeah. It should happen out of the water.
That conversation needs to happen out of the water because one person who's in over their head really is only in over their head toward the wave, and then they're able to manage the other factors and another person isn't. And it's the second person who it's going to be an issue for. The first person, like, there's people out of their depth all the time. It's just that how they've known how to manage that situation before and after.
And the reason that they're being there in the first place. So some people will need to, like, you need to be able to step up. So at Urban Surf, you need to be able to step up to the intermediate. So you're going to have a period of time where those other people in that session need to understand that you've just stepped up into that.
Yeah.
So that you are going to be shit and you're probably going to be shit for a while, but as long as you're not injuring yourself, which is a very very high factor on our, as a staff member, because we've seen it all. So not hurting yourself, but not hurting other people and not damaging other people's property, their boards and stuff while you're in there. And that is something, that's a consideration I think that is in the water, but it's more amplified whilst you're in the lagoon because you're in that tight space.
Mm. Yeah. And then you've got that, like, coming back to the same thing, like, where are you coming from in calling yourself intermediate or advanced? Like, let's just look at the checklist. Do you have the right takeoff for that wave? Yes or no? Okay, well, then in that case, you're not an intermediate and that's okay. That has to happen out, you know, knowing that that's the next step. The next step isn't looking like that guy because it's, you want to be like that. You know, it's your journey. Where are you coming from?
As coaches at Urban Surf, we're very much educated in how we talk to our clients, talk to our students, and let them know when they're ready for that level. And we've also got lessons throughout all of those levels, apart from the advanced and advanced turns. We don't have lessons in that quite yet, but we will. But if you're stepping up from a cruiser ability, we've got intermediate lessons. So my advice to anyone who comes to the lagoon first up, even like top end surfers, is to get one lesson at least, even if it's just a one-on-one or a group session in there, so that you understand and get that coaching whilst you're in the water.
The closer coaching is to the actual act of surfing, the more effective it usually is. I agree with that for sure.
Absolutely.
The question was about whether localism.
No, the question was, has the Olympic surfing being put on the Olympic stage, and the fact that we've got now wave pools and then we're going to have them all over Australia, if not all over the world, can you see that changing the way we coach, and can you see that changing maybe the way we look at the career of surfing?
I don't know if this is just personal opinion, so just kind of riffing on that really, because I don't know enough of the factors, but look, there are a lot, I can say this, like, my brother spent about 10 years trying to get into the Olympic rowing team, sort of 16 to 26. 18 sessions a week, like the workload was just...
It's incredible what the rowers do.
Right, and he was unsupported, unpaid the entire time. I think the prestige of rowing, and if you've landed in a spot where support is available to you as a surfer from early on, like really genuine support that sort of allows your surfing to develop, allows that person to develop in the right ways, then, you know, I think that the Olympics is going to be great. Like it allows more people access to watch that person and to support that person, and therefore probably more back and forth. I mean, this is all, it's like, to be honest, it's a bit pretty, it's surface level stuff. Like if more people are watching it, then yeah, it's probably better. I don't know. I think just the, like, it's already incredibly expensive to live near the beach in most parts of the world, and have access to surfing. Surfing's not a, you know, you need money to be a part of surfing. You need to get yourself a board, and for a lot of the world that's not going to be possible. You need waves, you need a board. The wave pool thing is the same. I see the same barrier to entry, you know. I just don't see I mean, it's a cost-based thing. To be honest, if I was really critically honest, it opens up surfing to a lot of, you know, it may have a bit of more, I mean, it's going to get more crowded, I think, is what's going to happen. And I think the level of how it gets more crowded is going to be something to take note of, because it's like, you know, how do you manage that before it becomes an issue for you? Because we all want to enjoy the sport. So if it does pan out in 5 years, it, like, there's another, I don't know, say 20%, 30% of people who kind of could surf but didn't surf much, now they are surfing a lot because it's more around, then I'd say that's going to yeah, just cause it an overcrowding around that sort of intermediate level. And I don't say that with any issues with intermediate level. It's just that like most people who are kind of fit and active can kind of get to that level well enough. So I'd say that maybe it'll fall out on that on a day-to-day level. And on a career level, I really don't know. I know that Italo Ferreira is going to be an absolute global superstar, partly just because he's such a legend.
But he's such an inspiration in the way he's come through.
He's rad. He's so cool. Yeah.
And he's so authentic to who he is as well. So he's one of the guys who does what he wants to do out on the waves.
Yeah, yeah. He's super cool. So, like, I mean, that's the image I get of him anyway. I've never met the guy. But, I think I don't know. I really – no other Olympic sport that I can see really supports athletes until they end up in the right spot at the right time. You know, for every one athlete who's getting supported young, there's heaps who aren't. Heaps and heaps. So, again, I think that just comes down to the, you know, people understanding where they're at with it, making the right decisions based on that. So,
so I grew up in Canberra, and when you mentioned rowing, I was scouted, I think it was in year seven. So the Australian Institute of Sport put money into scouting for rowing, and myself and my best friend were right height range, right leg length, right body shape and type, all that sort of thing. And it wasn't something that I was interested in doing. So even though they pushed my parents and said, she's got talent, she's got the right body shape and type we want to mold into our talent. I didn't do it. My sister did, but she didn't do it at a competitive, like not that high competitive level. She did it more just at the high school level competitiveness. But do you think that now that we have that sport, now that we have surfing in the Olympics, do you think that there will be scouts who are looking for talent and looking to mold kids into that or mold athletes into that? Or do you think
That's already happening now. It's just the mold process with surfing. I don't know how you're all of a sudden going to implement, like, if you're a young surfer and you're like 12 and you're a good surfer, right? And you've got one dude coming up to you from the surf culture that you know, respect, want to be a part of, and he's from a surf company currently doing whatever, versus a dude from the AIS coming up to you, good chance that you're listening
you're
to
move towards the surfing.
Yeah, right, unless your parents, but that said, I don't see that those AIS people, I'm sorry if you're listening, I mean, it's really heavy towards performance, and I don't think that many, a lot of bodies aren't ready for that type of performance, right? And there's a big break rate with athletes. So I would also argue that it's probably still, I don't know. I don't see one as better than the other. I just don't see how they would have to merge really well. And, you know, maybe the high performance center is able to, like all those types of places. And there's like some coaches here. Some of my friends are one of my friends is the coaches. I think he's coached for Surf in New South Wales or something. And he's an awesome PT as well. So maybe that's starting to merge in another way, sort of halfway between the two. But yeah, I don't think it's going to be like people rocking up. What might happen is a division between the wave pools and the other scene. Yeah, but then like you've already got the ISA Olympic. I've never watched an ISA contest in my life, but the Olympics was based on ISA. So it's
different method of competition, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Last question for you, Mitch. Actually, last two questions. What do you have going on right now that you'd like to share with my audience?
So I'm working through my experience with both surfing on the pro tour and then my own rehab journey with that. I've got it was the Natural Connection, but now it's called Surf Without Pain Guy, just to make it very direct about what I'm doing.
It's very clear. I saw it change and it was really good. Like I instantly recognized what you were doing.
Yeah, thank you. I just, basically I'm running a business that helps people, surfers on that front, get out of pain. And there's a lot of chronic ongoing issues that so many surfers have that are super misunderstood, and going to a physio or a chiro might work, but there's a good chance that you need to respect what surfing's demanding of your body and have the right input for that so that you can get yourself out of pain, get your body moving in a way that's going to let you surf. We all want to surf into our 60s and 70s like I do.
Yep.
That's why I put so much time into it. And it's not going to happen unless you're doing some type of management for your surfing. And what I'm doing is that management. And you can start, like, if you're in pain at 20, you need to start at 20.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as it happens, you need to get onto it, because your body's not just going to be like, at some stage, it just stops being sweet, basically.
I would argue that it needs to happen before you reach that pain level, because pain is the last resort for your body to tell you that there's something going on.
You've already done it. And basically, that's my entryway for people to understand the like brilliant world of being able to move well and knowing what to do when you're in trouble. So just simple, effective tools that you can do in like 15 and 20 minutes, which actually make a change. You have to just be consistent. And then once you've got past that out of pain stage, or if you're not in pain, there is
continue to do them.
there's levels to that as well, where you're just basically going into improvement. You're just going to be a better surfer, fitter, healthier, happier person. That's what I'd like to put out to everyone.
Including your breath work.
Pardon?
Including your breath work with that?
Yeah, it's always part of it. I mean, to me, breathing and movement are not separate. I just call it movement to keep it very simple, but there's always going to be breath work inherent in all my programs. And then on an individual coaching level, there's options for that. There's also, I'm coaching athletes through their movement and competitive lives as well. So I have some spots for individual coaching always.
Very cool. What is your advice for anyone wanting to get into professional surfing, or parents of children who have the potential to be a professional or high performance surf athlete?
Have some really honest conversations with yourselves and people that you really trust about what it is that you're doing it for. And if that's because you want recognition and stuff, that's totally cool. Like, everyone wants that. That's fine. And make sure you note that out. And once you've got that out of your system in that conversation, then move into like, what's really important to you about what you're doing? Like, what is really important to you? Is it, for me, it's just like, I want to be good at surfing. Like, and that's genuinely something that matters to me. What I've learned is that's quite a simple goal. It's like, it's not like, okay, I want to be enlightened. It's like, I just want to be good at surfing.
Yep.
I have other goals, obviously. But what I've found is having that clear guiding understanding of what I'm doing with surfing allows me to place it in the right place, and it stops me getting caught up with other things in it. And it also allows me to put other pursuits into, so like my, I don't want to say spiritual because it sounds like a toss, but like meditation pursuits and yoga pursuits, like they don't necessarily tie in with my surfing all the time. Sometimes it comes together and it's amazing. Sometimes it doesn't. But knowing what surfing is and what I want to do with it and what makes me feel good about it is really important. Okay, and it doesn't need to be anything other than what it is. What I'm trying to say is it can be super simple, and that's often what it needs to be for people. That would be my first thing, is really like the excitement about being good at surfing and enjoying surfing is really important, and allowing yourself to want to be good at it as well. Like, if you're not someone who's been called out as talented, like, allow yourself to want to be good at it and let that drive you toward learning about it. But make sure you understand when it's getting from, you know, when things start to come up because you're good at it, make sure that they get placed in the right basket of importance.
Yeah.
There are going to be things in your career incredibly important that you keep happening. That might be Instagram for the new generation.
Yeah.
But it's only important for keeping your career going, which is all inevitably to drive you to be better at surfing.
A means to a purpose, or a means to an end. Yep.
Yeah.
And having that order in the correct order. Yep.
Yeah. And if you're a parent, yeah, just don't, it's your responsibility to nurse any child's sporting journey into it being a positive part of them. And if you have
a issue, positive part of them, not you.
A positive journey for them, because any level of surfing or any other sport that I can see as well can be either incredibly positive or incredibly negative. And you need to be onto it. Yeah, because there's a good chance that most parents out there, especially a lot of dads, I can say, like, they've got stuff from when they didn't do things as a kid. And I've got stuff that I didn't do as well. Like, I didn't get, you know, to the 6,000s. Like, but you need to know what's yours and what's the kid's.
Yeah. Settle your shadows, or understand and work out what your shadows of your archetypes are. Yeah. And accept them for what they are, because they're going to be part of who you are, but just don't project them onto somebody else.
Fully. Just allow them to be there for yourself and understand that they're going to be there. And you're never going to have a perfect conversation with a young athlete. But basically all they need is their parents to support them. And they have other kids to compete with. They have, sponsors to learn how to interface with, which you need to help them with. And they have competition to learn how to deal with the pressure for. Parents' job is to fucking support the kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here with me today, Mitch.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Tanya.
hope you've enjoyed this episode of Amongst the Waves. I would love for you to leave your review on Apple Podcasts. Reviews help increase our rankings, let more people listen to the podcast, and share the love.